Kids and Youth Sports, its risks and rewards, keeping young people healthy on the field and off. Youth sports are an entrenched and largely beloved part of our culture. After all, who doesn't smile at the sight of a little batter during a t-ball game in full concentration mode, or a young swimmer with cap and great big goggles completing her first 25-yard race and grinning ear to ear? But youth sports can lose its innocence quickly when kids, under pressure to be superstars, can do things that harm their health. A new study, for example, looks at the impact of young people specializing in one sport at an early age. The risk? More sidelining injuries. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk with the author of that study and a local doctor who serves on the American Academy of Pediatrics Sports Medicine Committee about kids and sports. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In an age of multi-million dollar contracts and college scholarships, many parents have big dreams for their kids. So some encourage their son or daughter to specialize in one sport early on, train hard, join private teams and clubs, and face the best competition. However, new research shows that early specialization may not be the best way to go. Today, we're going to learn more about that research and what parents and student athletes can do to stay healthy when training and competing. Joining me in the studio, Michelle Labatz. She is a sports medicine physician at Intermed. She is also a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Sports Medicine and Fitness, and she serves on the Strategic Health Initiative Committee on Youth Sports and Health for the American College of Sports Medicine. And on the line with us from Wisconsin Public Radio, Timothy McWine. He's a distinguished scientist with the Sports Medicine Program at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, or in other words, he is a sports medicine researcher. As always, we want to hear from you. What are your questions about kids and sports and gleaning the benefits of athletics while reducing the risk of injury? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to start with what seems to be the hot topic that I just mentioned when we're talking about kids and sports, and that is the trend for young people to specialize in one sport. Instead of being a three-sport athlete, say playing lacrosse or soccer or tennis year-round these days. So, Michelle, I want to ask you, how prevalent is this trend for kids to, instead of doing three sports or two sports like they used to, really focusing at a young age on one sport, and what's behind it?
It seems like it throughout my sports medicine career that as time goes by, that's becoming increasingly common. There's probably some geographic discrepancies where folks from larger cities are going to be more apt to specialize really early. So some parts of Maine, we might be a little protected from that. But without a doubt, even here in greater Portland, I see that day in and day out. Those are conversations that I have daily with both friends as well as patients and their families. And kids are training, not only specializing, it's not only specialization of the athletes and their training, but the intensification. They're training harder, they're training year-round, but going into a single sport, specializing, that is an area of very hot research.
Here in Maine, are there some sports that this is happening more often in? I'm guessing soccer, maybe hockey?
Yeah, you will. And Tim should jump in here, too, because this is an area where he's done some research. But yeah, it certainly seems like, I mean, there are some sports that are kind of notorious for being single sports. So that would be like gymnastics, for instance. But you're seeing it more and more in some of the team sports. So soccer and lacrosse. And a lot of times there are sports where there's a certain amount of crossover, but there's a lot of similarities. So so athletes who are really sticking with running-based sports, so going from soccer to basketball to lacrosse, rather than sports that each sport focuses on a different body part.
Okay, Tim McGuire, I want to bring you into the conversation. You recently completed a study about these kids who specialize early in their risk of injuries. It's gotten a lot of national attention. Tell me about that study. How did you do it, and what did you find?
Well, yeah, we were very lucky. We were working with the National Federation of High School Associations. They gave us a grant to go ahead and look at something prospectively. And we know there's some anecdotal evidence and there's some expert opinion papers out there about specialization and some clinicians who reported that they were seeing more kids who specialize in their practice as opposed to multi-sport athletes. So we did a prospective study here in Wisconsin where we enrolled 1,500 kids from high schools, geographic representation in the state, and then we enrolled them. We had them fill out some questionnaires about what sports they played, how often they played them. We had them complete a specialization questionnaire, which actually determined their level of specialization as low, moderate, or high. And then we had athletic trainers follow them every day of every practice and every game at their high school that season or that year. And so we had these 1,500 kids participated in 168,000 practices and games. These are football, basketball, soccer, volleyball. And we found this trend that moderately specialized athletes were about 50% greater risk of injury than the low specialized. The highly specialized athletes, that injury rate went up by 85%.
What kind of injuries are we talking about?
Well, for our study, we just looked at lower extremity injuries. And part of that was it's not that we – I think, again, upper extremity injuries, shoulder, elbow, they're very important. But with the limited resources we had, we thought we'd just focus on lower extremity injuries. So we looked at ankle sprains, knee tendonitis, hamstring strains, ACL tears, hip impingement, stress fractures to the foot, to the ankle, or to the lower leg. So we looked at all lower extremity injuries. We excluded injuries that we didn't think would be affected, such as abrasions, contusions. Contusions, lacerations, things like that. We just looked at musculoskeletal injuries in the lower extremity.
And what kind of reaction has there been to your study?
It depends. Clinicians and sports medicine providers, such as Michelle, will say, you know, that you're confirming what we know, what we've known in the past. You're finally putting a number on this prospectively. Some people are welcoming of the message. Some people are less so. Youth sports and youth sports specialization is a big business. It's an industry, depending on who you talk to. $15 billion is spent on that. So those people that have the tournament sites and do the year-round training and the camps, they're not as excited with some of our data that we're presenting.
Sure. I mean, cover of Time magazine last week, the business of youth sports.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And just to follow up on a couple points that Tim was making, that the conversations that we have with patients every day, especially those patients who do come in with repeat kind of these overuse injuries, that the data that Tim and his colleagues are coming up with are very helpful in terms of helping our families make the best decisions for their kids. Different families are going to look at this issue of sports specialization and make different decisions based upon their resources and their goals. And the other point that Tim alluded to that I want to make is specialization isn't all or nothing. There's degrees of specialization. So are they participating more than 8 months a year in a single sport? And have they given up other sports in pursuit of one sport? So it's not all or nothing. It tends to be kind of this kind of gradual transition where as a kid kind of gravitates towards one sport or maybe find that they have a specific talent or affinity for a sport, that other sports kind of fall off to the wayside. So it's not an all or nothing. There's degrees of gradation in there.
I want to talk go ahead. Yes, Tim, go ahead.
I was going to say, if I could add something to it, I think one of the misconceptions we have out there is that specialization means the child plays only in one sport. And as Michelle said, we see degrees. We also said my typical specialization athlete, say, is a female soccer player here in the state. She may run cross country in the fall, but then three nights a week she plays soccer, and on weekends she plays soccer. She may play basketball in the winter, but then does soccer tournaments, indoor soccer tournaments in the winter, then plays on her varsity team in the spring. So, yes, technically she's competing in basketball, cross-country, and soccer, but she's really specializing in soccer. So there's people that say, well, my kid participates in multiple sports. Yeah, but if you're doing one sport to the exclusion of the others or at the same time concurrently, that puts you at risk.
Michelle, let's talk about something you mentioned just a little bit ago, the concept of overuse and training too hard. What do you see in your practice more often? What are the red flags that a kid might be training too much, too hard?
Well, I mean, there's a variety of kind of stereotypical overuse injuries. So that's everything from shin splints to stress fractures to a type of knee pain that we call patellofemoral syndrome. And so I'll give a kid kind of one of those types of injuries, but it's when you see one of those injuries that maybe doesn't heal like it should, or maybe if you see a pattern of recurrent injury, you say, boy, this kid really isn't giving themselves time to recover. And a conversation that I have a lot with families these days is you not only want to train hard and train well, but you also want to recover hard and recover well. You need to give your body adequate rest. There's a huge amount of data emerging on the importance of sleep in terms of not only performance, but also reduction of injury risk. And the importance of off days. When you train hard, hard days should be hard, and easy days should be easy, and rest days should be off. And that off time, that recovery time, that's when your body builds back up from kind of those little bits of micro trauma that you're doing when you're training and working hard. So at the end of a given workout, you've broken your body down a little bit. And if you don't give your body a chance to recover and kind of come back up, you're never going to be able to see the continued gains and performance that you want. And with the continued breakdown, that's when injuries occur.
Tim, the kids you're describing who are playing soccer year-round and other sports and being high school athletes, these kids aren't getting enough sleep, are they?
I doubt it. You know, they probably aren't at all. And I think, as Michelle said, that's a big issue. The training, the total training load, I think, is something we could also consider. For example, a University of Wisconsin scholarship basketball player can only compete 20 hours a week. But we have our high school athletes, some of them are doing 30-plus hours a week in the summer or with their other sports doing that to a training load that they wouldn't let our college athletes do. So where's the rest coming in? Where's the recovery? Where's the, I guess, the mental break from all the competition and the stress?
It's interesting you say that. University of Wisconsin guidelines, and I've heard that other colleges have strict rules and some, I don't know, the Ivy Leagues, I know Division III schools have very strict rules about how often kids are allowed to practice, but there are no such rules for high school students, are there?
Exactly, and I'm actually on the board of the Sports Medicine Advisory Committee for the National Federation, and it's one thing I think we should start doing at that level, and I broached the subject with them. I said, why don't we set some guidelines? And I know enforcement is not an issue, but we should at least be saying that if the NCAA can say a college athlete shouldn't participate or compete more than 20 hours a week, why shouldn't we do the same thing for an adolescent athlete?
Michelle, I've read of this concept that a child should not practice more than a number of hours a week than their age. So an 8-year-old shouldn't be playing any sports more than 8 hours a week, or a 15-year-old more than 15 hours a week. You're nodding. You say it's a good guideline, but, right?
Yeah. So there's a certain kind of common sense nature to that. There is some evidence to back some of that up. And that's really for structured athletic participation that, especially in those younger groups, so you talk about 8 years old, well, really their best participation in physical activity is actually with disorganized or unorganized sport. And what's interesting is if you look at the elite ranks, and this has been looked at in soccer players, for instance, that those soccer players who had more time in unstructured play, so, you know, dirt lot games, pickup games with their friends, before the age of 12, they were able to achieve more by practicing less and achieved at a higher level than those who were engaged in higher amounts of more structured activity. I don't know if that's making sense.
So the kids who were not coached until later in their childhood end up being better players.
That's right. That's exactly right. Kids.
I think they did some of that at UCLA, too. They looked with their college athletes.
Yes.
And looked at
free play
in college athletes that got scholarships. They were more likely to have free play as youth as opposed to structured play.
Absolutely. Yeah, that variety of motor inputs and motor outputs when the brain is still forming and the neural pathways are still forming. And early on, it's not about muscle building. It's about neural tracts forming. And so the bigger variety you can put your body in, upside down, you know, backwards, forwards, the more adaptable your body's going to be to whatever sport you want to go to. So the idea these days is really help a kid learn how to move well before you create the athlete, and then create the athlete before you create the soccer player. If you have a kid who's just coming in and learning soccer-specific skills, but they don't know the basics, they're only going to achieve a certain amount, and they're going to have to work a lot harder for it.
I'd like to touch on concussions a little bit. Tim, you're the principal investigator for two large concussion studies. What are you looking at?
We're looking at how concussions are managed with different levels of medical care. That's one of the studies, looking at how much athletic training coverage is available and what that does to both the reporting and the management. and different schools, because some schools have athletic trainers 30 or 40 hours a week. Other schools have athletic trainers for 1 hour a week or none. We're looking at that and then measuring quality of life and depression changes over the course of a year. And looking at that, we've got a cohort of about 2,000 kids in that where all high school athletes, any sport is involved. And we're getting a good, building a good database of what's going on. And by and large, we're finding that most of the concussions are resolving with minimal long-term impacts after even 2 weeks. We're not seeing some of the dire consequences we would think we'd see in terms of quality of life and depression. Our other study is a randomized control trial looking at soccer headgear. We're doing a large study trying to determine if protective headgear reduces the incidence of concussions in high school soccer or adolescent soccer. We know that concussions are a big role. As people don't realize that soccer, particularly female soccer, is second only to football in terms of the number of concussions that are occurring. And there's a big issue out there, and so we're trying to see if does soccer headgear actually make a difference and reduce the number of concussions.
Michelle, we've discussed concussions on this program before. One of the big takeaways I've learned from you is that we still have so much to learn about kids and concussions and their long-term impacts. It's great, Tim, to hear from you that it looks as though, you know, most kids are healing and healing pretty quickly. That's wonderful. Michelle, do you have anything to add to that? What have we learned most recently?
Concussion care is still, from a clinical perspective, kind of the swinging pendulum that I don't think has stopped quite yet. And I think one of the big changes over the past year, and this kind of taps maybe a little bit into what Tim is finding, is that we've gotten a lot less conservative in terms of how we manage these things. It used to be a kid got concussed, and you'd almost cocoon him, a quiet room, no screens, no social activity, and these prolonged times of periods of time away from school. And now we know that you don't wait for a concussion to heal and let a kid get back to their life. Getting back to their life is an important part of these concussions resolving quickly and completely. So we've really had a significant turnaround the way we manage these over the past couple of years.
So I want to change the question a little bit. We're talking about the risks of youth sports. We're talking about the risk of stress fracture, the risk of concussions. I want to talk about the benefits. Tim, do you study that, the benefits of organized youth sports for kids?
I haven't looked at that per se, but it brings up the whole risk. And one of the people say, how do we solve this problem? I said, one of the things that we're not doing well is solving the problem by talking about the dire consequences of some of these things. Scaring people doesn't seem to work very well. And I think we need to talk about it. I know I talked to our state association. If we want to highlight the benefits, let's look at college and professional athletes, whether they're here at the University of Wisconsin or professional athletes that people may emulate, and let them tell their story about how they participated in multiple sports. For example, three famous football players here came out of the University of Wisconsin. One, J.J. Watt, I think he raised $27 million, they said, for hurricane relief down in Houston. And all the brothers came through here, and they all were adamant. They're like, no, we just didn't play football. We played everything in high school to go ahead and get this. So there's a benefit. I think there's so many benefits from high school sports in general. We know that kids are more likely to stay in school. They're more likely to not be involved in drugs or alcohol. They're less likely to be truant if they get involved in these organized activities. So the benefits are there. And I can tell you firsthand from seeing with my kids is how they went through and did all their sports and what it did for their life. I think the benefits are so great. Any risk we talk about, we got to make sure that the scary risks don't outweigh the benefits that are out there.
Yeah, I would agree. And to add to that, the academic benefits of being involved, not just in sports, but in physical activity of some type is really coming to the fore. And especially as our schools are kind of struggling with budgets and what role does recess play? What role do sports budgets play? How does physical education, which is really an important part, I think, of kind of helping our kids to move well, especially as a society, as we kind of move away from, you know, the time where, you know, kids are kind of free play and, you know, kick the can and kickball at night. You know, how else are our kids going to learn how to move well? And some of the national governing bodies for sports are kind of taking that on as part of what's called an American development model. Some of it's also going to hopefully start to happen more in physical education in our schools as well.
I want to talk about the American development model a little bit after the break, but we do have to take a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email at talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law firm of Eaton Peabody's Financial Institutions Group, working to provide effective counsel to meet the demands of banking clients in New England. The Jackson Laboratory, nonprofit genetics research in Bar Harbor, discovering precise genomic solutions to disease, JAX.org, and Bay Chamber Concerts, committed to enriching communities with high-quality musical performances in Midcoast Maine. Learn more at baychamberconcerts.org.
You know that little sticker on fruit? How when you pick it off, it, like, damages the fruit?
And then trying to flick it off your fingers, right?
And you're like, why does it have to be so hard?
That is design. And design affects everything around us.
And if done right, everything around us could be transformed to bring a better experience.
Ideas about the power of design. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And that's tomorrow afternoon at 1, and you can also catch it Wednesday evening at 11.
Dentists have played a role in the opioid crisis.
I have dentures, and I went to have some legitimate work done, and I got some Percocets. And I realized that by going to another dentist, I could get some more Percocets.
In Massachusetts, dental schools are working to fix that problem. That story, plus the latest on Hurricane Irma, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, weekday evenings from 4 to 6:30.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about kids and sports and the best strategies for keeping them healthy on the field. Joining me in the studio, Michelle Labatt. She is a sports medicine physician at Intermed and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Sports Medicine and Fitness. On the line with us, Tim McGuine. He's a sports medicine researcher at the University of Wisconsin. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Michelle, before the break, we were talking about the American development model. What do you mean by that, and what's going on out there?
So American development model actually is kind of born out of an originally Canadian concept called long-term athlete development. And it's basically kind of codifying a way to bring kids up from very young and first exposure to sport and physical activity, and then kind of in a developmentally appropriate way, helping them to become the best athlete that they can or the best athlete they choose to work towards. And so starting some of the steps that I had mentioned earlier in terms of really kind of working on fundamental movement patterns. Can the kid skip well? Can he jump well? Can he land well? And then from there, building on some more sport-specific skills and then kind of tactical skills for the game, and then moving kind of up into different levels of competition. So instead of just taking a six-year-old who still doesn't really know how to jump and land and that type of thing, and then putting them and trying to teach them a lot of, you know, we keep kind of using soccer as our example, but instead of trying to kind of teach them specific skills to the sport, give them the general stuff first and then let them build on that.
And Tim, is this movement toward this development model kind of in part in reaction to the reality that talented kids are getting recruited younger and younger for college sports teams or for special programs?
I'm not sure. I don't have the exact data on that. It could make sense. The model itself seems to make sense to me. I don't know how that would affect the recruiting or maybe the identification of the really good athlete moving forward, though.
Yeah, I guess I would think if anything, it's actually a bit of a pushback against the high degrees of specialization, because with early specialization, so early and late specialization are two very different things. But with early specialization, there's a lot of injury, there's a lot of burnout, and there's a lot of dropout. So the pool of elite-level athletes who are potential for NCAA competition or even Olympic or elite competition, those sheer numbers are dropping off because people aren't kind of making it through the pipeline. And, you know, you're talking about kind of the early recruitment that's happening, you know, these, you know, sixth and seventh graders out of Texas that are getting recruited for college scholarships. And the New York Times a couple years ago had a fabulous article, and Anson Dorrance, the UNC women's soccer coach, was in there saying, you know, I'm here because I have to be, but it's killing us. He says, I hate to give scholarships to kids that over the long term don't pan out. And when you look at, for instance, Anson Dorrance, one of the most successful collegiate coaches of all time, one of his proteges, Mia Hamm, she didn't specialize in soccer until she was 15. She would not have been at those showcases that Anson Dorrance is now looking at. So, you know, incredible talent. Tom Brady, one of our local guys, right? Not really local, but local enough. He didn't start football until he was a freshman in high school. And, you know, he was drafted by the Expos as a catcher out of high school before going to Michigan, where he was not the starting quarterback. So you don't have to be kind of chasing these dreams at a high degree of intensity real young to have great levels of success later down the road.
We're going to go to Randy from Indianapolis. Hi, Randy. Go ahead.
Wow, man, I'm here and you guys are beaming loud to Indianapolis. No, I'm up in Freeport. I'm a friend of Michelle's and just wanted to say thanks. You guys are talking about some great issues. I just wanted to point out as well that performing artists, dancers, and musicians at a young age are also going through some of the same stresses that the sport athletes are in terms of long hours of practice and trying to be a success and chasing their dreams. And we know even less about the issues of mental health and physical health with musicians and performing artists. And so there's some work that's starting in that area as well, taking what we already know about sports medicine and applying it to performing artists. And I just wanted to recognize another population that would benefit from all of this discussion that you're having today.
Randy, I'm so glad you called. You know, it seems intuitive that we might be talking about dancers, but are you also talking about cellists and pianists?
About 50% of musicians have some form of hearing loss. So that's, now I'm not saying the youth ones do, but when you look at them across the board, so that's sort of the concussion of the music world. And if you think about how many times someone is practicing maybe 6-8 hours a day on a violin or a cello, moving that bow back and forth. If you were running and you had stress fractures, you'd want to know how many miles they were running. Nobody knows how many bow strokes people are taking on a violin or a cello or something like that. And that repetitive trauma and how it builds up, we just know nothing about it. And ideally, we'd like to find other measures of improvement in music that aren't based 100% on practice time. And we don't really have good metrics to measure that.
Hi, Randy. It's Michelle.
Hey, Michelle.
So Randy used to be in charge of injury surveillance at the NCAA, and he has recently founded an organization called Athletes in the Arts. It has a very nice website. There's a lot of really good kind of user-friendly information on there. So he's really put his money where his mouth is on this and is really serving as an advocate for that population.
Well, I'm so glad, Randy, you were in Maine today to call into Maine Calling and take part. Really, really interesting points you make. We're going to move on to Jessica, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. I just had a comment for the panel. I think it's curious. I happened to hop in, and I was just chatting with my friends over lunch about the last two seasons. Our son plays hockey and soccer, and then he also, the hockey season stretches up here in New England, as we all know, and so then it goes into hockey and lacrosse, and we've tried to have him shoulder those two seasons and have one practice and then get in the car and then go to the other practice. And as a result of the last 2 years, he's had overuse injuries. So I think for this year, we're trying to alleviate that for him. We're going to say, listen, you can start the other one when this one stops, instead of playing one sport to the exclusion of everything else. We're trying to say one at a time. I know today he had to practice from running straight to hockey, and that seems like a lot for your kid.
Jessica, what do you think your son is, how is he going to react to what his mom and dad want him to do? Shoot, I think we lost her. Tim, I'm sure Jessica's story is one you hear a lot.
We do.
What guidance, what advice do you have for parents who have a kid who is perfectly happy going from one practice to another practice and does not want to quit one or the other?
I guess I would say, do they really, really want to do it? Or do they think they're pleasing their parents by doing it? That's one of the things we ask kids, you know, why you're doing this. Well, I want to do it. Why? Because it makes my parents happy. It's sad to hear that, but I think it is. But I think also that Michelle talked about rest. I think it's State of Michigan's talking about having a week downtime between sports, that if you finish your fall sport, you can't get in the gym or do anything for another week before winter sports season would start. I think it's a great idea. The idea of rest and recovery and just taking a mental break is wonderful. If we could go ahead and do that, I don't know.
So it's interesting. She talks about kind of hockey and lacrosse, because there does seem to be a cross-pollination between those two sports. And even like Wayne Gretzky was talking about how the time he spent on the lacrosse field actually benefited him on ice. And I guess one conversation I have, because I would agree with Tim that some of this is done to please others, but there are some kids who really get enjoyment and have fun doing this, and we want sports to be fun for kids. But what I tell parents is, you know, if all your kid wanted to do was eat carrots, well, eating carrots is healthy, but they need to eat other things as well. If all they want to do is play soccer all year long, or all they want to do is one sport to the other, you need to change it up a little bit. And so just because something is good and healthy, and or just because something is fun and healthy, doesn't mean it's good. Too much of a good thing is not a good thing.
Jessica, thanks so much for your call. We have a bunch of messages coming in. I'll take a Facebook post from Hannah. At the Maine Concussion Management Initiative, our experience demonstrates that education is the key to concussion prevention. I would like to ask the group if they agree. I am the Head Injury Tracker Project Administrator. I'll turn this to you, Tim.
Yeah, I think it's very important, making people more aware of the education. I think, and again, getting back to our own research, when you have trained people on the ground recognizing it, and the average days out for concussions that we're seeing is 14. You know, as little as 5 years ago, it was probably 7 days for a concussion. So we're recognizing, we're educating people about it, recognizing it, and then treating it successfully and resting, and then bringing them back gradually. The education to do that, I think, and maybe that's one of the reasons why we're not seeing these dire consequences in terms of quality of life being impacted 3 months down the road, or depression.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566 and our email address talk@mainpublic.org. We have an email from John. I am a firm believer in the need for cross-training and multi-sport involvement. Pairing two sports together so they complement or balance each other is a rule for some. But some sports encompass more whole-body training than others. Some are inherently whole-body pursuits, gymnastics, martial arts, etc. Michelle?
I think he brings up some good points and that whole kind of concept of variety. So don't just do running sports, but if you're playing soccer or cross country in the fall, consider swimming or diving in the winter rather than basketball. So the bigger variety, especially when they're young, the more different directions you can point them in terms of ways to move their body, the better off they're going to be in terms of long-term development of their skills, as well as maintaining appropriate and healthy levels of physical activity actually throughout their life. If they can stay active through adolescence, chances are you've got an active, healthy adult.
Do you agree with him, though? I think a point he's making is that if you do something like gymnastics or martial arts, there's less of a need to try to balance that with other sports because they already are balancing it within the demands of that sport.
Okay.
I think that's what he was saying.
Yeah, and you know what? And that's I can see that point. I don't know, kind of, and Tim might have a better sense of how this pans out in terms of injury data. So one of the problems for both of those sports is that they tend to be year-round sports, so they're not sports where there's really a down season, and especially for gymnastics, because gymnastics isn't really one sport. For girls, it's four sports. And one of the reasons why I love gymnastics for young people is that for most of the time, especially really young, it's the closest thing that replicates free play. They get to walk on the beam. They get to swing from the rings and the bars. And there's really not many other sports that allows kids really that freedom of motion that early gymnastics training does. But as they go up through the system and just the volume of training increases, I think some of that benefit of the whole body training is canceled out by the sheer volume of training and kind of that lack of recovery.
Tim, thoughts?
Yeah, I agree, and I think your thoughts about gymnastics encapsulate that perfectly. The whole body training, I get it, and I think it's important. One of the people, and I talked to an old physical educator from years ago, and he said he thinks some of the problems we're having today is because the early physical education classes we had 30, 40 years ago stressed tumbling, movement patterns, and things like that, and those are gone now. And he was wondering if some of the things we're not learning those basic movement patterns to transition to a sport culture is one of the reasons why we're having more injuries now.
I'll go to Todd, who's calling from Presque Isle. Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
I'm interested in this topic, and I read the Time magazine article for this week. And some of the research that I've seen, and this is in decades past, was that young kids, although parents put pressure on them to be skillful and to score points and goals and to be the best they can, one of the most important priorities that kids have is to be with their friends. And if you're with your friends, a lot of times the intensity of what you're doing is far less and far less opportunity to be injured.
Yeah, I think you kind of wrapped it up quite nicely that it used to be that kids, we played in the community leagues and while fun is still at the top of the list, kids are now being kind of pulled out of their community to play with these travel leagues. So that camaraderie, that being with their friends aspect of it, certainly teammates become their new friends, but there's a different dynamic that goes on there than used to be. Little League, for instance, is kind of experiencing some difficulties with this, with a lot of the baseball kids kind of going away from the community leagues and into kind of more of the travel leagues. But Tim.
I was worried about the kids are left behind. I get it. The kids want to be their friends. I think that's wonderful. I was worried about the kids are left behind. What if the parents can't afford the extra leagues, the travel, the club tournaments when they're 10, 12, do they ever give up on the sport? Do they just say, well, I'm never going to go out? Again, we're seeing, people think talking about football losing and enrollments and numbers. I mean, in the state of Wisconsin, we're losing basketball, we're losing soccer, we're losing a lot of sport participants, not just related to in-school enrollments. And I wonder how much of that is that, well, if I didn't really spend all the money, we didn't have the money to spend on this when I was 10, 11, 12, I might as well not even go out as a high school kid.
Yeah. And
I think we've lost a great opportunity there. This equalizer that athletics is to bringing kids together will be gone.
Yeah. And, you tap into that. There was this Ameritrade study that came out just a couple days ago that showed that about 20% of households in the U.S. spend $1,000 or more per month per kid on sports participation. And so, like you were saying, sports used to be this kind of class equalizer, and now kids from lower income households, their rates of sports participation is dropping off, and it's really becoming something that is really kind of more and more to the well-to-do.
Mm. Well, Todd, thanks so much for your call. Go ahead. I have to go to break
after this. I would say
this.
That here.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that, too, and the money aspect is important. I say in Wisconsin, nobody rides public transportation to hockey practice. Nobody does.
Todd, thank you for bringing up an important angle on this. We do have to take another short break, but first a word about Monday's program. We will be discussing the services in place to help Maine's immigrants and refugees. If you have questions or comments, go ahead and email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Freemasons in Maine, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
If you listen to the way New England is depicted in TV or movies, you'd think we've got one accent with some variations. But take a closer listen.
I guess that Sherry didn't bother to start my car.
My father sometimes hides his boots by the road in a park. Pat laughed and laughed at the merry sound of the shouting.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll dig into the way our region talks and the imaginary lines that divide us. I hope you can join us.
Join us for Next coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling.
I'm Bill Littlefield. In 1971, the Supreme Court voted to send Muhammad Ali to jail, and the verdict would have stood if not for a law clerk named Tom Krattenmaker.
I sort of said, Mr. Justice, I have an opinion on this. I think it should be coming out the other way, and here's why.
That's coming up this week on Only a Game. Join us.
Only a Game tomorrow morning at 7 a.m.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program Sports Medicine and Youth. In the studio with me, Michelle Labatz, a sports medicine physician, and on the line with us, Tim McGuine, a sports medicine researcher. He's joining us from the University of Wisconsin. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Waterville and Anthony. Hi, Anthony. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, football always gets the bad rap as, you know, being dangerous, but I read years ago that the most dangerous sport is actually cheerleading, that they're flipping each other up in the air on a track. Is this true?
Tim, do you know?
It depends how you define what's dangerous. I know for a number of years, that's what I'd show a slide and say, what's the sport with the highest risk of catastrophic head or neck injuries? Everybody's running. You know, it was cheerleading. Dance cheer.
Yeah, the National Center for Catastrophic Sports does support that. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that cheerleading, they're not in the gym practicing on the mats. They're in the parking lot practicing on the macadam. Oftentimes, cheerleading is not as closely coached as some of the other sports are. They're not considered a varsity program in a lot of areas, and so they don't get the same resources that others do. I know that some of the national cheerleading councils are addressing some of that and putting limits in terms of kind of heights of pyramids and stunts. So it is trying to be addressed, but it's a sport that really has been under-resourced, and I think the cheerleaders paid for it.
Thank you, Anthony, for your call. We're going to go to Bath and Tom. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hello. I'm enjoying this discussion very much. I think it may be useful to have folks differentiate between what most of us grew up with as a concept of sports, and that was enhanced organized play, essentially. Whereas today, high school sports is very much a competitive athletic endeavor, and it seems like those are synonymous, but they're not.
Oh, sure. Tim, things have changed, haven't they?
Exactly. I think that's a great point. That's exactly it.
Thank you, Tom, for your point. We have a tweet right here from Sue. Why does single sports lead to injury? Speakers didn't say. So what is the reason that doing the same sport intensely for most of the year it leads to injury? Is it the repetition?
When you do this, I mean, it's a great question. When you do the same thing over and over and over again in the very same way, you're overusing certain parts of your body, and certain imbalances of strength and flexibility kind of add into that. But it is just kind of the repetitive kind of use of individual body parts that put them at risk for overuse.
We'll go to Lee calling from Wyndham. Hi, Lee. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I am out driving, and I just went by a sign that said soccer tryouts or mini soccer or something for 2 to 4-year-olds. And I thought, whoa, where are we going with this? My kids are now grown, but when they were 4 years old, they started, and I thought that was young. But I'm thinking, wow, they're going now back to 2-year-olds. I just think that's a little bit pushing it. That's all.
I would be really interested to see what a 2-year-old soccer tryout looks like.
Exactly. Even if it wasn't even getting a 2-year-old to play soccer is a little bit young. And it just makes me think what a crazy world this is getting to be with our kids and like pushing them so young. And I know that my children, they both started with one of those crazy moms, you know, carrying her son out to the field and, you know, helping them, you know, run down the field. And I look back and I think, wow, they both started at that age. But by sixth grade, they had had enough of it and they had turned to other activities, you know. And I think that's the problem, is we're starting them so young, they're burning out.
Yeah, where did you see that sign at?
I saw it at, what's it called? I know, it's near Stevie's and Wyndham. The Rotary. Sorry, it wasn't coming to me.
Oh, my goodness.
So, wow.
Yeah, so I just thought I'd share that and, you know,
crazy.
See how other people felt about that age starting.
Oh, my gosh. So. Tim, thoughts?
It's a recipe for burnout.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, I'm sure they're cute in their uniforms.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you both for being here. What an interesting discussion. I can tell from our Facebook page that people are continuing the discussion on Facebook, and I really like to see that happen. Michelle Labatt, sports medicine physician at Intermed and a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Sports Medicine and Fitness. And she serves on the board for the AAP's Maine chapter. And Michelle, you've got some long titles here. The board for the Strategic Health Initiative Committee on Youth Sports and Health for the American College of Sports Medicine. Timothy McQuine, a distinguished scientist with the Sports Medicine Program at the University of Wisconsin's School of Medicine and Public Health. We've posted an article from NPR that features Timothy McQuine on our Facebook page. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. We had production help from John Keimel, and Owen Manahan took your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.